Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Did you know that this week is Salt Awareness Week? Yesterday, we talked about Poison Week, and actually Poison Control Week is this week as well. Salt Awareness Week, I don't know, maybe we could consider, no, I don't think we can consider salt a poison, but it certainly can create some issues if we are intaking too much of it. And so that's kind of the purpose, I think, to make people aware. We'll find out as we visit with our two friends today. Dr. Ted Goodfriend, UW physician, professor emeritus of medicine and pharmacology. He's a nationally recognized expert on high blood pressure. So it's great to have him with us today. And also Gail Underbakke. Great to have her back. Well, they both been, it's been a long time for both of these guests. Gail's a registered dietitian and as the nutrition coordinator for the Preventive Cardiology Cardiovascular Medicine Department of the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Gail, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Dr. Ted Goodfriend, thank you so much as well.
My pleasure.
Great to have you back. Gail, what is the goal of this world? This is World Salt Awareness Week.
Exactly. This movement to reduce sodium in the diets of the population actually has started in other countries. Finland had a big movement years ago, and the United Kingdom has been working on it for a while as well. And Japan also had an effort to reduce the sodium intake of their population in an effort to reduce the diseases that are related to that high sodium intake. So the United States is sort of just getting started with their part in this salt awareness process. And some of these, some of your listeners may be aware that the dietary guidelines that were released at the end of last year did place more emphasis on reducing sodium. So we're getting some of that in this country. Some of the food manufacturers, big companies and food manufacturers, have made pledges to reduce their sodium content in the food. So we're moving in the right direction. But it's basically disease prevention is the goal.
And when we think about salt and too much salt, I guess words like hypertension and high blood pressure come into play, Dr. Goodfriend. Let's hit hypertension first. What exactly is hypertension? And is it the same thing as high blood pressure?
Yes. Ah. Hypertension is just the $64 word for high blood pressure.
Okay.
And the problem with this definition is that there is no exact cutoff for what kind of blood pressure is too high or too low. It depends on your age. It depends on what other illnesses you might have. Like if you have diabetes, then your pressure should be lower. The general cutoff, just for the sake of abbreviation, is 140 over 90, the top number being the highest number your blood pressure reaches during the cardiac cycle, and the second number being the lowest, so 140 over 90. If you are that high or higher, you have high blood pressure or hypertension. But as I say, children, the cutoff is lower. Diabetics, the cutoff is lower. But it's more a condition than it is a disease. It's like weight or height.
Yeah. So what is it? What makes it a problem?
High blood pressure damages all, pretty much all of our organs where the blood circulates, in particular the heart, the kidneys, the brain, the eyes, and the peripheral vessels. So the conditions
pretty much everything.
Just about everything, right. I haven't mentioned the fingers, but just about everything. For example, the heart. The heart has to work harder if it has to pump higher pressure. The kidneys are bombarded by that pressure. So are the vessels around the body, like the a main artery, the aorta. So are is the brain. And the conditions that result in increased amounts if your pressure is high would be heart attacks or heart failure, stroke, kidney failure, and aortic aneurysms, a ballooning of the vessels, either in the aorta or the brain. So blood pressure is kind of a risk factor or an aging factor, the thing that wears out other organs.
We're talking with Dr. Ted Goodfriend and Gail Underbakke today about World Salt Awareness Week, and we're talking about hypertension and blood pressure with them. I didn't give the number, so let me do that right now. If you have a question or comment, maybe you or someone in your family has to deal with high blood pressure. What steps have you taken to address it? Maybe you have some questions about that. What about your attitude toward cooking and foods and nutrition? We can certainly talk about that as it relates to salt. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us. The email address is talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Gail, what would be the amount? Is there an amount of salt or sodium that we should be
aiming for?
Yeah, or, aiming for.
Yes,
that's the word to put.
Yes, I think yes, definitely there is. The average American sodium intake is listed as something like 3,500 milligrams a day, so 3,500. The dietary guidelines would like to see that as a first step, no higher than 2,300, so cutting it by at least a third to start with. And then there's been a recognition over the last few years that certain groups in our population, and it's actually a pretty big number of us, anyone who's over the age of 50, anyone who has high blood pressure, anyone who's African American, the goal is to get the sodium in their diets down to 1,500, so 1,500 milligrams of sodium. And the reason that those populations are separated out is that they tend to have higher risks related to sodium.
Yeah.
They it has more negative effects on their health.
Now, if you're looking at that 1,500 milligrams, if you're looking at that on a teaspoon, or
right.
how much does that look? What does it look like? I'm sure a lot of people have that question.
Yes, exactly. And a teaspoon of salt, like table salt, for example, is somewhere around 2,200, 2,300 milligrams. So a lot of times people will say, well, I'm supposed to aim for 2,300 a day. Well, that's a teaspoon of salt. I don't add that much to my food. But, of course, the issue is that something like 80% of the sodium that Americans consume is not added by them. It's added in the food processing or at the restaurant where they eat. So it isn't, you can't afford to add a teaspoon of salt to your food and still be at the target sodium intake.
Yeah. And even if you wouldn't add any salt,
right,
to your, which I, you know, I never put, almost never would I put salt on anything.
Right. But if you're using a frozen potato thing, or the chicken breasts that you buy are frozen and they're soaked in salt water before they're frozen, so they're higher in sodium than what you would imagine they would be. A slice of bread has sodium in it. Just all those different foods have more amounts. So it's actually, you almost have to take an active role in avoiding salt, even if you don't add any.
Yeah.
By modifying the choices that you make in restaurants and the types of prepared foods that you use, in order to get down to 1,500, you'd have to really pay pretty close attention.
Hmm. Well, you know what? Every one of our lines is full, so let's go to the phones and take some calls here. David in South Milwaukee, we turn to you first. Hi, David. Thank you for calling.
Good morning, folks. I have a question. I have an unusual diet, and I could easily eat almost no sodium in my diet. I cook my own foods. Other than buying frozen vegetables, I believe there's some salt in there. Is there a minimum amount of sodium that one needs? And I'm going to tie that in with cholesterol as well. I understand the body makes its own cholesterol, but I think I read that somewhere that the cholesterol is not of a real high quality that it makes. I'm wondering if you need cholesterol. I'm always debating whether to get skim milk or to get 1% milk, that sort of thing.
Okay.
Well, I can comment about the need for salt.
Okay.
We definitely need some salt. And by the way, I should back up and say that sodium is half of salt.
Right.
Salt is sodium chloride. So
right. When
we talk about sodium, we're talking about table salt.
Mm-hmm.
There are other salts, but this is table salt. And sodium is the dominant ion there. And there are tribes underdeveloped aborigines in, for example, South America, that eat 10 milliequivalents. I mean, almost no salt whatsoever, and they survive. You definitely need some salt, but you need very little in order to survive.
Hmm.
So I would answer, in this country, there's no way we would be able to eat and get less salt than we need. So don't worry about that.
Is there a a milligram amount that you're talking about?
Generally, they'll say 500 would be plenty for survival. 500 milligrams per day would be plenty for survival. And if you drink milk, for example, there's 120 in a cup of milk. If you've got even a slice of bread, there's probably 150 or more in a slice of bread. So I bet you're probably getting maybe a little more than what you think. But in general, 500 a day is survival. That's mm-hmm. plenty for survival, unless you're a marathon running athlete right. or something like that.
Or do a lot of sweating.
Yes. If you're outside in very hot weather, working hard and sweating a lot, then your requirement would be higher.
And the cholesterol?
The cholesterol that your body makes is just fine. It's a great quality. You don't need to take any in your diets. And in fact, as Dr. Goodfriend was talking about, some populations in the world that don't use much salt, there are a lot of vegetarian populations in the world, and vegetable foods or plant foods contain zero cholesterol, and those populations live just fine without eating any cholesterol. So you really don't need any.
Mm-hmm. I got to make one warning comment here. This issue gets really complicated.
Yes.
If you start thinking about ramifications. If somebody is elderly and on a blood pressure lowering medicine, let's say, and they already have been diagnosed and they're taking pills, and they move to a hot climate, or it gets hot in the summer, or they get a fever, or they get diarrhea or vomit, they need more salt to survive. Mm-hmm. So there are exceptions to our generalization that you don't need very much.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right, there you go. Thanks, David, for calling. Appreciate it. And on to Jerry in Franklin next. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And yes, 2 weeks ago, I just made the diabetic list. So this is a great show for me. Just listening to you, there's so much more I need to know about where salt is coming from. Albert, my biggest dilemma now, from everything I've given up in this battle, is just trying to find good recipes or even a place to start. Do you have any suggestions?
So, cookbooks, for example. Yeah.
Yes. And I think you've got a few options there in terms of diabetes. And usually when you get a cookbook that is targeted to a population or a person who has diabetes, they also take into account the cholesterol, the types of fats, the sodium in the recipes. So usually you don't have to buy like three different cookbooks in order to try and get everything under control. But I would say the American Diabetes Association, anything that they publish, is going to be helpful.
And they've got a cookbook, too.
Several different kinds. Yes. And the American Heart Association also has a variety of cookbooks, some of which are targeted to people who might have what we call type 2 diabetes, which I suspect is what you've been diagnosed with. So those would be options. And then another place, one of the references that we were planning to talk about today is National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute reference called the DASH diet. It's called Dietary Approaches to Stop Hypertension, but it's a great diet guideline that actually helps you cut down on salt, but also increasing fruits and vegetables in the diet, which would be appropriate for someone with diabetes, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that website has just a bunch of recipes, and it actually has menu plans and all this kind of thing. It's free.
Yeah, so we'll put it up on the Facebook page if it's not on my go to the Larry Mueller show, but it's probably if you put in DASH diet, you're probably going to come up. I'm pretty sure.
Right.
Of that.
That's the problem, you know. And then when you're first starting out, Larry, you know, it's just so overwhelming.
Yeah.
Right.
One food can be good here, but it's not good if you're a different type.
Exactly. Yeah. And I would just encourage you to start out with a moderate approach. Don't feel like you have to make drastic changes in everything. If you start by looking at your portions, one of my favorite guides gets off the sodium topic just a bit, but the plate, when you look down on your plate from above, if half of it is filled with vegetables, and a quarter of it is filled with starchy foods like potatoes and rice and noodles and bread, mm-hmm. and a quarter of it is filled with a nice lean protein, that's as complicated as it has to get to treat diabetes. And then if you want to lose weight, just get a smaller plate.
Oh, very good. Yeah, we should mention that in raising blood pressure, salt is only one of several influences.
Yes. What are some of the others?
Weight. Obesity. And this may surprise you, alcohol.
No?
At over 3 bar-sized drinks a day, alcohol raises blood pressure. You think of alcohol as dilating your blood vessels, making you flush, and people fainting from too much alcohol as though they had low blood pressure. But chronically, high alcohol intake in some populations has a greater influence in raising blood pressure than salt itself. So weight, alcohol, and salt.
There you go. Thank you so much, Jerry, for calling. Appreciate your call. Talking about high blood pressure, hypertension, we're talking about salt. This is Salt World Salt Awareness Week with our two guests today, Dr. Ted Goodfriend, UW physician, professor emeritus of medicine and pharmacology, nationally recognized expert on high blood pressure, and Gail Underbakke. Gail's a registered dietitian at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Great to have them with us. Certainly, you can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email talk at WPR.org. And Judith just let me know that Dash Diet link is on the Facebook page already. So go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and you'll get it. Judith Sears-Poisson, the person who did that, and also our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll take more of your questions here on the Ideas Network. Susan in Mequon has a question relating to blood pressure. So let's go there to Susan. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I don't eat any kind of processed foods, mostly local, organic, if when possible, vegetables. So I don't get the salt that way, and I don't have high blood pressure at all. I can't tell you the numbers, but I do like salt, and I put it on my oatmeal and put it on my popcorn with olive oil, probably more than what you would be saying. So my question is, what am I doing to my body? And
okay.
Plus, I must say I'm 66, so and very healthy. What might I be doing badly to my body by probably having more salt than what you're recommending?
Dr. Goodfriend, you want to comment on that?
Yeah, very good question. All of these have been very good questions. There are very few things you can do to prevent the development of high blood pressure if you're destined to get it. And, of course, I would like to ask the caller what her family history is. Among the things you can do to try to keep your pressure low is to stay lean, avoid getting obese, and to eat less salt. That's not a guaranteed preventative, but it's one of the few things you can do. So what you may be doing bad if you eat more salt than recommended is making yourself prone to the development of high blood pressure as you get older. Now, you're already 66, I think you said, so you're probably home free. I would ask about your family history of stroke or heart attack. You may be among the people that we call salt insensitive. So the population kind of divides into people who are very sensitive to salt, that blood pressure goes up like a shot if they eat too much, and people who are kind of immune to salt, whose blood pressure does not go up very much when they eat too much. And for those people, I think a moderate salt reduction is appropriate, and you shouldn't get too fanatic about it. But it will help prevent the development of high blood pressure.
What about salt substitutes? And I'll use a product name because I know what Mrs. Dash is an example of that. They claim sodium-free.
Right.
Are those?
That one is, yes. And I think the best advice I could give anyone is just look on the labels, because some of them are just herb combinations, which is what Mrs. Dash and all those variants are. Mm. But there are others that are maybe half the amount of sodium that regular salt has. They could be reduced, but they're not actually sodium free.
Okay.
So they might be worth, just read the label and then you'll know what you're getting for sure. The other thing about those salt substitutes is the replacement for the sodium is typically potassium. And for most of us, potassium, if we're healthy people, potassium is good. Getting that extra potassium in our system actually helps flush out a little bit of sodium. But for certain people who may have heard from their doctor that their potassium levels are a little bit high, they should be real careful about salt substitutes.
Okay.
Yeah, the current rage is to worry about not getting enough potassium. I mean, that's the new shift in emphasis. Because when foods are processed, they take out the potassium and add in sodium.
Sodium.
Oh. Exactly. Yep. One thing I was going to mention to the caller, too, who was not sure how much sodium she was using, there have been times where I've suggested that a person get an empty salt shaker and that they measure into that salt shaker maybe half a teaspoon of salt and then use that as a gauge for how much they're actually using in a day. So when
that's a good idea.
Yeah, when she puts the salt on her popcorn, she can shake it out of just that little shaker. And when she puts it on her oatmeal, she can take it out of there and just see how much does it add up to in a day. And it may not be as much as what she thinks.
Yeah. Thank you. Can one be prone to stroke by having too much salt if their blood pressure and everything else is normal that you wouldn't know about?
The easy answer is no. It rides very closely associated with blood pressure, the incidence of stroke. Mm-hmm. There's two kinds of stroke, the bleeding in the brain and the clots in the brain. The bleeding in the brain is the one that usually is a result of high blood pressure, and it's very pressure-related. Now, there are animal models of heart disease and vascular disease that are dependent on salt and not related to blood pressure. But we don't know too much about whether that pertains to humans or not. Hmm. So in general, follow the blood pressure.
Okay, there you go.
There is one other thing, or a couple other things, actually, that sodium does influence, and that would be bone health to some extent. If a person was consuming a very high sodium diet, that does tend to lead to the loss of more calcium in the urine. And over years and years, and especially if the person was prone to osteoporosis or thinning bones, that could be an additional risk. People who have kidney stones are advised not to overdo the salt, because, again, that puts more calcium in the urine, and that can increase the risk of that. So, and there's also been some studies looking at stomach cancer and high sodium diets in populations. That's a less strong connection. But there's a couple other things other than just blood pressure that relate to sodium intake.
All right. There you go.
Very informative.
Bye. Thanks, Susan. Al in Land O'Lakes, on to you now. Hi, Al. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for having us on. It's very timely because I have to go in on an outpatient basis tomorrow. Anyway, I have a huge disparity with my blood pressure, and especially the machine versus the cuff. But they scared the snot out of me last year, and they came up with 190 over 90. And so I started following up and, you know, had glucose level of 123. It's down to 116 now. And then last time I was in there, which was 2 weeks ago, it was 115 over 70. But I have a hard time understanding the disparity here and what actually is normal.
All right.
For a guy like me, I'm 62, and I have a chronic degenerative joint disease and this and that, whatever, and get a lot of injections for that, but they scared me pretty good about being pre-diabetic and that. So what is normal?
All right, Dr. Goodfriend?
Well, you have what's called labile blood pressure. It goes up and down, and that's very common. First thing I'd tell you to do to simplify your outlook is to look only at the top number. So that 190 is frightening. The 115 is reassuring. If everybody in the world had a systolic 115, they'd all live to be 90. So I'd worry about the top number. I would say that you ought to get your blood pressure measured more often and keep a record of it. And maybe you could associate the high pressure with certain events or times of day. You say you have arthritis, and one thing I'd warn you against is excessive use of what we call non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, the aspirin-like drugs that are used commonly for pain and arthritis.
What about aspirin?
Aspirin is the least dangerous for blood pressure of all of them, but Tylenol is absolutely safe. So if you can get away with Tylenol for pain, you're better off. I would avoid things like indomethacin, Indocin, and some of the stronger NSAIDs. They definitely tend to increase blood pressure. You notice I keep saying tend to and may, because this is all a highly individual issue.
Yeah, there you go.
And as far as the blood sugar, I think he's right that if you have a blood sugar of 100 to 125, you're in the borderline range. And once you get two blood sugar measurements, fasting blood sugar measurements of 126 or higher, then you're diagnosed as having type 2 diabetes. So the dropping of his blood sugar was encouraging, too.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks, Al.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call. Katie in Delavan, you are next. Hi, Katie.
Hi. Not sure if this is going to be helpful for anybody else, but I don't seem to be getting any responses from my doctors. I'm 68, and I've always had low blood pressure. Like if I'm in the hospital lying down, it's the diastolic has gone down to like 42 or 38, and nobody gets excited about it, even though, you know, I pass out. But lately, my blood pressure, you know, has risen, and it's like 102 over 56, typically. And I've also developed a colitis that I'm losing a lot of water. So there's days where I'm so weak that I actually eat a little bit of salt because that somehow makes me feel better. And
yeah.
I'm assuming it raises my blood pressure. Any suggestions on if this is a dangerous thing? Because I've actually not exactly blacked out, but I've just fallen downstairs, collapsed and fallen downstairs. And I don't know if it's from, you know, an arrhythmia or I don't know. And nobody seems concerned. And my heart seems okay.
All right. Well, what do you think, Dr. Goodfriend?
I think that's a great blood pressure if you don't pass out. But if you are collapsing, then it's too low. And we always ask, what are the symptoms? You know, if you're getting lightheaded, then it's too low. So that systolic of 102 is right on the edge. At your age, you begin to wonder and worry about the second number, the low number. You'd like to have it a little higher than that. I'd like to see that low number between 50 and 60, the diastolic pressure. The other thing is your colitis. If you're losing a lot of fluid in your stool, then you are probably depleting both your sodium and your potassium.
Mm-hmm.
So Gatorade may be the drug of choice for you, something that has a little bit of salt and a little bit of potassium and some water, but I defer to Gail for that.
Boy, that would have been my best advice as well. I don't have anything to add to that.
All right.
So if you're having an arrhythmia, I've got mitral valve. And I actually do take Atenolol, but it's only 25 milligrams, and I've been on it for 20 years, and my blood pressure was low before that. Could it be, like an atrial fib or something that would cause?
Sure. The only way to tell that is to be wearing a monitor when you pass out so that they can tell what your rhythm is. Atenolol is going to make it harder for you to compensate for a drop in blood pressure. It's a beta blocker, and it blocks one of the reflexes we have for keeping our pressure up. So you're getting that to prevent an arrhythmia, but we aren't, from what I hear you saying, we're not sure you actually have an arrhythmia. Mitral valve prolapse leads to atrial fibrillation, but you may or may not have it. You really need to wear a monitor long enough that you would experience lightheadedness and be able to see whether you actually have an arrhythmia or not.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We have a lot of emails, too. Stephen LaCrosse says, when I was in my 20s, 30s, and 40s, I had no salt cravings. Now that I'm on the back end of my 50s, I crave more salt when eating. Is this just me, or is it a body adjustment to age? And then he adds that also Cooking Light magazine and Weight Watchers are good sources for recipes. So.
Those are great ideas. I think he may be hitting on the way that we adapt to what we eat. So in other words, if we eat foods that are higher in salt, we expect foods that are higher in salt. And so he may have, over time, with the food supply in the country, including more processed foods, maybe the restaurant foods that he gets or something like that, have actually trained him to expect more sodium. So maybe that's what's happening. I don't know of an increased sodium. Well, I guess that is when you get to be say 60s, 70s, 80s, the taste sensitivity does go down in older adults. So there could be the more of what you might call a craving because it's not being sensed as accurately as it was at a younger age.
But try other spices.
There you go.
Yeah. Try some other spices. Okay. And also, the Weight Watchers and the Cooking Light magazine are fine.
Yes.
We should also mention, my goodness, since Dr. Zorba Pastor is a regular guest and has a national program with us, that he has a Heart Healthy Recipes and Cookbook at WPR.org. So I should mention that as well. Marion says, I don't add salt to my food, use very little processed food. As a child in northern Wisconsin in the Spooner area, we were given iodine tablets. I got those too, to avoid goiters. Now I buy iodized salt, but if I do not use hardly any iodized salt, am I getting enough iodine in my system? Is the salt in the processed food iodized?
That's a good question, and I kind of doubt it. I don't actually know that. But this issue has come up, people wondering about whether we're getting enough iodine in our diets these days. In the older times, when foods were not shipped around the country, we just ate from our own soils. Ate what we grew in our gardens. Then if we lived in a place where the soil was depleted of iodine, then we did need more. But as time has gone on and our foods are actually now international, coming from all kinds of soils, and the chance that the foods are low in iodine is much less now. So we're getting more that way, in addition to iodine being used in certain bread processing in factories or places where they make bread in large quantities. Dairy, as far as disinfecting dairy equipment, milking equipment. So there's been more iodine in the food supply as a rule.
Okay.
Now, so I guess I would not worry if she's adding iodized salt when she adds it. I wouldn't worry about being too low in iodine.
Is there any difference between sea salt and ordinary table salt? You know, you get these recipes, use sea salt.
Right, right.
Sea salt.
I'm so glad that came up because that's a very common question.
Jim in Black River Falls had that question.
Yeah. and really, when you look at it, the difference is not, they're both salt, table salt, sea salt, they're all salt, but it's the size of the crystal. So when you measure out a teaspoon of sea salt, you don't actually get as much because the crystals are bigger. There's more air space in the spoon. Whereas if you're getting table salt, the crystals are all uniform and you can fill the spoon up fuller. So you get about, like I said, 2,300 milligrams of sodium in a teaspoon of table salt. And it's usually somewhere around 1,900 in a teaspoon of sea salt. So it's a little less, but not significantly less. So that I would not view sea salt as something that can be used just at will or as much as you want.
All right. Well, let's go to Kathleen, in Hatley. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi there, folks. You guys are all doing a great job, and I come from a little different perspective. I work as a nurse in a nephrology clinic, and I know you were talking a little bit about kidney and salt and potassium, and our take on that certainly is untreated high blood pressure is one of the major causes of kidney disease, and in addition to other comorbidities or other diagnoses that patients do have, it can certainly wreak havoc on your other organs as well. Another point I think that I was going to make was the fact that my dad used that Morton salt substitute for years. Had I known then what I know now, I would have ripped it right out of his hands because that does certainly increase the potassium like you talked about. And we have to gently or sometimes firmly remind our patients that the heart is a muscle and the extra potassium can, you know, cause irregularities with the heart. We have to tell them to seek emergency assistance if they notice any of those symptoms. So I guess that being said, that was interesting, and I wanted to just bring in the kidney piece as well, which you did a little bit. Then another substitute that we have found, my husband and I personally, to have fallen in love with lately is McCormick has a beautiful spice out there called Mediterranean, and it is so flavorful. We're using it on a lot of things. So I guess just a little bit of an input on some of that, and thank you for the remainder of your discussion today. It's A1, and so I'll end with that.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Comments?
Yep, thank you for saying what you said, and I think you bring up some interesting ideas for seasonings, alternative seasonings. You mentioned the McCormick products. They've got a variety of like pepper grinder kind of things, too, with different flavors added. And other things I would suggest to add flavor to food, certainly all different kinds of pepper, from the black pepper to the cayenne pepper, but also lemon acids, vinegars, mm-hmm. and lemon. There's so many different delicious flavored vinegars available now. When you've got that acid added to the food, it just sort of brightens up the other flavors so you don't miss the salt mm-hmm. as much. And then also things like ginger, fresh grated mm-hmm. ginger added to soups or stir fries or even salads of various types. That's got a little bit of heat to it, but yep. it also it kind of brightens the flavor as mm-hmm. well. And then certainly the traditional herbs, a variety of herbs. I think the curry powders, there are different levels of heat in the curry. You can have mm-hmm. some of those that are just delicious added to vegetables and meats as well.
Yeah, some great curries out there.
Yes, yes.
Dr. Goodfriend?
I just wanted to comment about the arrhythmia issue that the caller yes. raises. A much greater, in percentage of total, a much greater cause of arrhythmia is low potassium. High potassium tends to cause slow heartbeat. Most of the tachyarrhythmias, the fast heartbeats, are caused, if by anything, by low potassium. So except in people with kidney disease, I worry that our population is not getting enough potassium.
Okay. Once somebody is put on blood pressure medication, is it possible to make enough lifestyle and dietary changes they can actually be taken off those medications eventually? Is that a goal to have?
Well, I don't know if it's a goal, but it's definitely a possibility. I see many patients who, by losing weight, by cutting back on alcohol, by increasing aerobic exercise, by the way, it's got to be aerobic exercise, mm-hmm. no isometric exercise, mm-hmm. please, and by reducing salt intake modestly, can get off of blood pressure medicines if they're on relatively low doses in small amounts. Yes, that's an objective that's worth keeping in mind.
And Tammy and Marshall, on to you. Hi, Tammy.
Hi. My question is regarding how we might contact manufacturers of, for instance, crackers to get some low-sodium options. A cracker that I like does have a low-sodium option, but it's just crazy how salty even that low-sodium option is. So I just don't know how we might encourage them to do something less. And then even when we cook, national TV person adding salt to the pasta water, because that's the only chance you get to salt the pasta. And I just don't do any of that because I might be hypersensitive, but I would like a lot less salt in what I see, and I don't eat certain foods because they're crazy salty.
Yeah, you're kind of breaking up, but Gail, you want to make a comment here?
Yes, I think she makes a good point that the models we have on cooking shows are pretty free with their flinging around of salt. So looks worse than it is. But as far as how to influence manufacturers, I think your biggest power comes in your buying. So if you buy the products that are lower in sodium, they'll keep making them. We've talked to restaurants and other groups, and they say, well, we'll do it. We'll cut the salt, but people got to buy it, or we're going to take it off the menu again. The other option, though, is on websites. Most, I think every company would have a website, and they usually have an email option where you can give them feedback on what you'd like to see or which products that you do appreciate that they've produced. And it's worth it because that's what it's all about, is they're marketing to the consumer. So if they know the demand is there, we'll get different types of products available.
Well, this is World Salt Awareness Week, so it's a great time to take a look at your own consumption of salt and take a look at your own blood pressure or hypertension. And I'm really glad that our guests were able to come by and remind us about that and give us some more information. Thank you so much for being with us.
Glad to be
Appreciate
here.
Appreciate it very much. Dr. Ted Goodfriend, UW physician, nationally recognized expert on high blood pressure, and Gail Underbakke, registered dietitian, and is the nutrition coordinator for the Preventive Cardiovascular Medicine Department at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. And we'll try not to make it such a long time in between their visits. We'll do it again with them. Thank you so much. Well, coming up, we're going to kind of go to salt water in a way, because we're going to be talking about exotic pets, some of them saltwater fish. They don't mind the salt in the water. We'll learn a little bit more about that. We'll also talk about choosing and caring for exotic pets with Mike Hoffer, owner of Tropic Life Pets in Milwaukee. Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.